in just about a minute or so. After that, at 11:30, Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News investigates the world's biggest oil company, ExxonMobil. Yeah. Way back about 40 years ago, Exxon knew that the way they were doing business was shifting the climate in ways that could be very damaging to human society, but just decided not to bother doing anything about it. They funded denial instead. How is it possible that you're going to hear all about all of this stuff? It's certainly not in the interests of, well, let's say Chevron, which funds a so-called public media institution, to tell you about that. See, we tell you about it because you fund KBOO. That's right. What? You aren't one of the members of the KBOO Foundation? You can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says donate today. And you can be one of the folks mentioned when I tell everyone listening that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And the Deakum Street doorway, Linton Feed and Seed Store, offering essentials for farm life in the city, including animal feeds, garden and landscape plants from local farms and nurseries, and seed garlic. Open Thursday through Sunday, 10 to 5:30. I'm at Northeast Deakum and 8th entrance on 8th Avenue. DeakumStreetDoorway.com. And now, the incomparable Radio Zine. That's not the Radio Zine. So we're going to hear the Radio Zine in just another few seconds right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth at Mississippi Pizza on October 4th from 5 to 8 p.m. Spaceship Earth is a multimedia production by Laurie DeMaron about being more mindful of our actions. Also performing will be special guest Eva Riversong of Portland's local band Soul Nectar. Again, that's What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth, October 4th at 5 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What are you doing this Thursday at 11 a.m.? Hopefully you're listening to Between the Covers, where I talk with living legend, author of over 60 books, Ursula K. Le Guin. Le Guin says, "You can't change society without changing the English language." Thus, her new book, For Writers, Steering the Craft, inevitably engages class, gender, capitalism, politics, and morality, which for her is not separate from grammar and punctuation. Again, it's
Ursula K. Le Guin
this Thursday at 11 on
KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, 90.7 FM in Portland.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO FM. I'm your host, Eric Tegedoff, and today I'm speaking with Hector Tobar. He's the author of Deep Down Dark, the story of 33 men trapped in a Chilean mine for 69 days. And I was wondering if I could have you describe how the men got trapped in that mine.
Well, yeah, they were working 2,000 feet underground, most of them. This particular mine was essentially a spiral highway that was cut into a block of a stone that's like granite. It's called diorite, but it's as hard as granite. So the mine is a spiral. And at the same time, there is an abyss next to it, an empty space, which is where the ore has been over the years. So they've been mining this for 100 years. And so they've been emptying out the ore. And so they've left this empty space, and that is weakening the mine. And so what happens is that finally, after 100 and something years of mining this mountain, the mountain gives way, the rock gives way, and it sets off a chain reaction where this stone goes crashing through the heart of the mine, and it knocks out all the levels of this ramp that is the only way in and out. It's a ramp that is about as big as, not big enough to fit a dump truck. And so these guys are working at the bottom. The rock comes crashing through. It seals off the ramp, so there's no way out. And most of them run down to the bottom of the mine, to this one particular room called the Refuge, which is about as big as your typical radio studio. And they crowd in there behind a steel door and wait for this earthquake that's happening outside to stop. Because when this stone falls through the mountain, it sets off a chain reaction of rock exploding under pressure, boulders going down this particular highway that they would drive, the men would drive through, and going down caverns. So it was a really frightening experience, but that's essentially how they're trapped.
Yeah, the size is kind of unimaginable. You don't really imagine that they had all of this room for like a dump truck and things like that. I mean, you were talking about the mountain itself being hollowed out. Mm-hmm. How much did the owners of the mine know about the condition of the mine itself?
Well, this is a mine that had been operating for more than 100 years, but the general manager of the mine, who I interviewed, said he believed the mine had another 20 years left in it. Now, if you look at that in one sense, it means, well, you know, we can keep working in there safely, but it also means that this is a mine that was near the end of its life, you know, because 20 years after 115 years of exploiting the mine means the mine is almost done. And so they had many, many warning signs. There was an increase in this thunder the men would hear, because they would hear these falls of rock that came from the abyss. It would be akin to sort of hearing an avalanche, you know, because the sound would be transmitted through the stone. Sound actually travels faster through stone than it does through air. So the sound would travel through the stone, and they would hear this distant rumbling, which became more frequent. There were also cracks in the otherwise very stable and sturdy structure of the mine. There were cracks in the ramp. So there were several warning signs that this was not in good shape.
Yeah, but it was still profitable. So I imagine they still wanted to stick with it. And
right. Capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. and everyone knows the ending, so it's not giving away the ending. But do you know what happened to the managers of the mine?
The owners of the mine were brought forth on criminal charges by the miners, because in Chile, as in many countries in the world, individuals can request a criminal prosecution. And so the prosecutors in Chile investigated and found that there wasn't enough evidence for criminal charges against the mine owners. However, there still is a civil suit pending. So the men might actually end up owning the mine, as a result of this lawsuit. So that's still up in the air. They've been held accountable in the court of public opinion. They've been shamed, you know, by an entire country. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Most definitely. What happens if they own the mine? I mean, they can't.
Well, there's the San Jose mine is part of the San Esteban Mining Company, and there is another mine that's still operating.
They would get that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
that's pretty wild. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
well, yeah, the mine owners, I'm sure, are not in good shape at this point.
They're not in good shape now.
That's kind of what I wanted to hear, just from hearing some of the conditions of the mine.
Right.
They had that mirror test, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
Yes, which also comes out in the movie. You know, there's a movie coming out November 13th, mm-hmm. and they actually have a scene with the mirrors, you know. And so what happens is that there's cracks in the stone. And the question is the crack part of a larger structural failure? So if the crack is like an earthquake fault, where it means that a larger piece of, you know, a rock is moving, you put these mirrors between the crack, and if the mirrors crack, it means that these blocks of earth, of stone, are moving in opposite directions. And so many times they'd place these mirrors in and the mirrors were not cracking. And so the miners, owners would say, see, everything's fine.
Although some of the miners thought, oh, they're going up there and replacing right. mirrors or exactly, something like
exactly, exactly, right, exactly.
And so it's like, it would be like the San Andreas on miniature a little
exactly,
bit.
Exactly, exactly.
Overall.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a fascinating test that they came up with. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the structure of it because it feels so much like a fictional work. You know, I mean, it's it's an incredible story. And it just flows so well.
I take that as a compliment. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't mean it as, I actually think it's beautiful and I think it's so well written. I was wondering how you kind of coalesced all of the stories because it's 33 men as well as the family of the men, Chilean officials.
Right.
I mean, there's so many stories that come together on this like very clear thread that I can see and that I think works beautifully.
Well, you know, I was really helped because I had done, I'd written three books before, including two novels. And so I think novels for me are built around strong characters. They're built around really a memorable setting, a really powerful setting. And so I worked on learning about who the people were, you know, the characters in quotes, you know, because they're real people. They're not fictional inventions, and finding out more about them. And I was really lucky that I had a lot of people among the 33. There were many who just opened up about their previous lives, why they got into mining, about their childhood, you know, about there's one man who was a street urchin. Another man whose mother died delivering him, another man whose father died when he was a teenager. So I was able to sort of, you know, learn who they were and what made them tick. That's one thing. And that's really critical when you're writing any work of literature is character is essential. And then I was invited by them to learn about mining and learn about mining culture. And so I learned, how mining worked. I also visited the San Jose mine several times and then went to other mines. And so each visit, would give me a new visual clue to build this world, you know. And so, and having written fiction, you know, I know that you transport somebody to another place by making it come alive on the page with details. And I've also been a reporter. I've been a reporter for 20 years. So, and now I've been for 15 of those years, I've been a reporter who also writes novels. So I've been sent out into the world to look at things, and I'm also writing novels at the same time. And so I have that muscle is there. And so when you begin to hear stories and you begin to hear absurd twists to the story, you know, when you hear something that's really surreal or something that's especially tragic or emotive, you don't, you rush towards those facts, you rush towards those details, and you just embrace them and you try to find out more about them. And, so that's the way I work. And so thank you. I thought of it as a nonfiction novel, you know, in the tradition, it's a really wonderful American invention. It might be the best contribution of American writers to world literature is the nonfiction novel. It's a really unique American construction that comes from American magazines and Truman Capote and others, you know?
Yeah.
And so I felt I was writing in that vein.
Yeah, that's absolutely how I felt about it too. And it's funny because the men themselves become celebrities and are celebrities.
Right.
And I think in a way that only fiction can do it, like, you relate to Holden Caulfield as a real person in a way you don't relate to celebrities, really.
Right.
You know, like you don't relate to Kanye West in the same way that you relate to Holden Caulfield. And I think you have a more intimate connection with Caulfield than Kanye West.
Well, I think that's, you hit the nail right on the head because these men were treated as celebrities when they got out. And so the Chilean media sort of didn't really see them as real people. And so part of my job as a writer is to find out who the real person is and give them that real person a presence on the page. And so you do things that seem to sort of work against the adventure story. You know, it works against the adventure story to find out what the guy did when he was 15 years old, what his first mining job was like. But if I tell you that his first mining job when he was 15 was that he had to wear a leather harness, and I know the name of it now, the capucha, and he had to carry out 100 or 200 pounds of rocks on this harness when he was a kid, and that was his first mining job, it gives you a sense of his evolution as a human being, you know, that his humanity has been defined by suffering in this job, but also a test of manhood that is involved in the job. And so then you know who it is. You know who this real person is who got stuck and became famous. And that's absolutely essential, I think, in any work. Because, you know, in daily journalism, you know, the guys reporting this down in Chile, they have, you know, tight deadlines. They have to make a deadline at the end of the day or the middle of the day, sometimes several deadlines in a day. And they are winging it very often. You know, they're trying to get as much information as they can. And when you wing it and you don't have much information about people, oftentimes you come up with stereotypes and cliches, you know, or melodrama. And that's what the men were subjected to in the daily coverage of the Chilean newspapers.
Yeah. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO FM. I'm Eric Tegadoff here with Hector Tobar. And I think you speak tongue in cheek about the spirituality of this whole situation.
Right.
There's the situation where the family wants a psychic to come to the mine.
Oh, that's right.
someone with a divining rod and things like that. So I kind of feel like you were always, you know, it's just such a big part of the culture that it would be impossible to ignore.
Right. But there were so many things like that. And I think that, yeah, there was the guy with the divining rod who the minister of mining told me about, who went, you know, and told the drillers, you're all drilling in the wrong place. But then there were other things, you know, like people telling me that the men's cell phones were ringing or making phone calls days afterwards. Or Yoni Barrios, whose mistress told me that, you know, she felt his presence in the room and that she felt him speaking. She heard him speaking her name and all these things, which to me, I understand, you know, because I've been through some loss and, separation and death. And when something traumatic happens to you, you begin to project your love for the person. When something traumatic happens to someone you love, you project your love for this person onto these objects. And that's what was happening. People were having these psycho-emotional, spiritual reactions to what was happening.
Yeah, it's the cell phone thing is quite a modern twist to that idea.
Right.
You know, but it also struck me those first 17 days that they're down there without any contact from the outside world, there is quite a depth to their humanity, I think, because they really come together, and outside of anything spiritual, they seem to really band together in an incredible way. I mean, I think I was on the verge of tears just thinking about them down there and how brave they were, really.
Well, to me as a writer, I just felt that these passages had this amazing purity to them and this amazing sense of humanity and mournfulness, you know, people mourning their own passing. I mean, you can imagine what that's like to be placed in a situation where you're slowly dying, but you have days and days and days in which to think about how you lived your life and how people are going to live their life without you. And so that, to me, it was so powerful. And the fact that they still met every day and they shared meals every day, even though the meal was one cookie, and then they started to skip the meal, but they would still pray every day. That to me, it was just, I just felt that was the heart of the book. The book, in fact, when they're finally discovered by this drill, that's already half the book, because to me, those 17 days were the most important thing they lived through. And in fact, the men sort of felt the same way. To them, you know, they kept a secret. They wouldn't tell anybody else in the outside world like the most important things that happened. And that was sort of the biggest secret, was what it felt like to be in this space for 17 days. And I felt so honored to be the writer chosen to tell that.
Yeah, it's kind of like living in your own coffin at a certain point.
Because right, exactly.
There's really no guarantee that they're going to make it out alive. And I'm sure most of them, or all of them, thought that they were not going to make it out of there alive. And you've described it as a parable before too, as well. This is kind of like this true story that's become a parable
right.
In a lot of ways, which I think is really interesting as well. this is somewhat related, I think, but Octavio Paz has this line from Labyrinth of Solitude: "History has a cruel reality of a nightmare," and that's where that's kind of where it comes true. It's like, the history of these men at a certain point is so cruel, but has become a parable for the way that people can come together in a lot of ways. And it's.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that there was, I sort of really began to understand it as this folktale. you know, of a modern day folk tale. In fact, when I met the men, even when I had just heard, I hadn't really even heard this full story yet. I told them that. I said, you guys have lived the great adventure story of the 21st century. This is the Odyssey of our times. And it's my job to be your Homer, you know?
How did they feel about that? How did they feel about this idea that they were in like a folk tale? Because I know that a lot of them suffer from post-traumatic.
Right. No.
Probably all of them had some sort of very traumatic experience afterwards.
I think that almost all of them did. Almost all of them had the trauma hit them, some for the days and weeks after, some a year later, some 3 years later, some 4 years later or 5 years later. They've had their first real sort of, you know, flashback to what happened underground. I think that having said that, they also felt a strong sense of wonder. You know, I was lucky enough to interview them maybe 5 or 6 months after they had been rescued and to be the first one to which they were going to tell everything. I heard things that many of these guys had not told their wives. You know, they didn't tell their wives because they believe they should be strong. You know, in a relationship, you don't want to, if you share something really painful, you feel like you're putting a burden on that person. And so their instinct is to protect the people around them, not speak about it. And so many of them, you know, told me these stories and they had this strong sense of just wonder and awe that they had seen these miraculous things happen. And so I think that the book feels like a folktale because it felt like a folktale to listen to when the men were telling it. And you mentioned parables. It's really funny because one of the men trapped down there was an evangelical Christian, very devout, kind of severe guy. Who, when they start to pray, someone asks him to say a few words, and he begins to tell Bible stories, you know, and he tells stories of Jonah and the whale, and you know, many of these stories, and it was just sort of that. So that's a parable within a parable.
I have another question about structure when it comes to certain passages that you kind of leave in Spanish, or that you want the reader to read in Spanish. And I think in a lot of cases, it's because they're more powerful, right? How did you choose which phrases would be in the book in Spanish? I mean, obviously Mario's nickname kind of has to be understood.
I think that unlike the last novel I wrote, just about every phrase that's in Spanish either has a translation or you can tell the meaning through context, you know, almost everything. But there were some words that were really difficult to translate, you know, swear words, you know, swear expressions. You know, I know we're here, the FCC might be monitoring us, so I won't get into, you know, details. But, you know, there's a certain, for example, vulgar Spanish phrase that Mario used again and again that is common to the Southern Cone that involves, you know, a really vulgar description of a woman, part of a woman's body. And so I had to come up with a good translation of that, but I also wanted the reader to know this is what this really means. And, you know, as ugly as that sounds, it's not quite that ugly sounding in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So I wanted, you know, it's a dance. You know, you want to give people enough so they can feel a little bit of the uniqueness of the culture. There's a wonderful Spanish, a Chilean word for labor called pega. Pega is your job. You know, "Esta es mi pega," and I had to learn that. I use that a few times. You know, there's the word phrase huevones, which is not a vulgar phrase, but it just means like dudes, but also means part of a man's body, essentially. And so all these things, you know, I just wanted to sort of give enough to the reader so they could sort of feel their way a little bit into the culture. But at the same time, I didn't want to lose the reader. I didn't want to seem like I was some sort of a, you know, showing off my Spanish, because the book is written in English. So it's a balance that, you know, you find.
Would it be okay if we talked about Translation Nation?
Oh, sure. Yes.
Because I think it's becoming sort of a hot topic, with people like Donald Trump and things like that. And you wrote it 10 years ago. It was published in 2005, right?
Right.
And this was all sort of looking back, I think, kind of in the wake of 9/11. And there was so much, we were so focused on the Middle East and the war in Iraq that we were kind of forgetting about the issue of immigration. And now that's kind of getting going again. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed anything in the last 10 years since you wrote the book that you would add to the book if you could or would?
You know, a lot of people have pointed out to me that the book is very optimistic, you know, because the book really is about the strength of Latino culture and its ability to produce leaders, its ability to produce an identity, its ability to produce movements and organizations. And so, you know, people have this whole idea of Latino immigration that's tied to victimization. So people want, even people within the Latino community, they believe that our story is a story of victimhood. We've been victimized by imperialism and poverty in Latin America, and then we're victimized here as part of the, you know, underpaid proletariat, you know, we're, and to me, it's true that, you know, we are, that we are the victims of class structures and international capitalism that sort of makes us, you know, makes our people suffer many things. But, you know, my book and my life have been about finding the strength among Latino people, especially, you know, my family's from Guatemala. I'm son of Guatemalan immigrants. And so I never really thought of myself or my family as a weak culture. I always thought of us as kind of fighters, you know, improvisers, you know, lovers of life. And so now in the years since Translation Nation was published, you know, the anti-immigrant movement has become especially ferocious. You know, it was already sort of strong, beginning to be strong in the, you know, early 2000s. Then it became, you know, it had started in California, the anti-immigrant movement, and had become a nationwide movement in the years since Translation Nation was written. And so that I didn't address in the book. And to me, I'm glad I didn't, because that's not really what my book was about. My book was about how these people from Latin America were transforming the United States. That in fact, it isn't the case that Latino immigrants are trying to be separate from the rest of America, but in fact that what's happening is that Latino culture is changing what it means to be American, right? And I think that there still is not really, we're still not a very self-confident culture. We don't really have, we still haven't produced an intelligentsia that is bringing forth a more accurate and subtle and textured portrait of our community. You know, that's still, to me, we're lagging way behind, you know, other groups in this country. And my novel that I wrote after that book, The Barbarian Nurseries, is a lot about that. It's a lot about how it's about the anti-immigrant movement, but it's also about class differences in this country. And I have this one line in The Barbarian Nurseries that I write about the Latino intelligentsia such as it is. You know, they're untenured professors, unpublished novelists, unheralded poets, you know. And so that's sort of where we are. And I think that part of my mission as a writer is to bring forward this idea that we produce amazing people and that we have strength as a culture and that we are redefining what it means to be American. And I think that that is still true. And I think the resistance movement to the anti-immigrant movement, the Dreamer movement, is a glorious chapter in American history that has its antecedents in, and you know, pardon the comparisons, to Reconstruction, to W.B. Du Bois, to the movement for, you know, Black civil rights, and you know, I'm proud to be part of that, and I think that that's something that you know, all of that has happened in the years since many of those things have happened in the years since I published the book.
Yeah, one of the things I took away from it was how well established the Latino communities were, and right. Especially in California. You start in the 60s, and I'm from Florida, actually, so it's very much a crossroads of a lot of Latin cultures, Puerto Rico and Cuba, right. Especially. And you talk a lot about Che Guevara, the image of Che Guevara.
At the beginning of the book, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, I was wondering, as you were saying, you know, some people feel that they're still in the state of victimhood, but also there's also the organization that's going on in a lot of communities. Does Che represent the victimhood of that, or does he represent the power that can come to these communities?
I think that Che represents, still to this day, this idea of resistance, of he represents the idea of resisting by doing action outside, you know, of the mainstream. I think that he is now generalized. He's sort of like he's the kind of guy you could see tattooed on somebody's arm in Peru, which I've seen, and also in LA, you know, and that's something that unites Latino people in California and Peru and other places. And, you know, he's also someone who is a mythic figure who's true personality has been obscured a little bit by all the sort of legend building that's taken place around him. You know, for me, Che was both, you know, a poet, an idealist, a doctor, but he was also a little bit of a, you know, Robespierre type figure, you know, someone who's a hard man, you know, someone who made some poor decisions, tactical decisions in his life, and someone who was very kind of full of himself, you know. But who sort of created this idea of the thinker warrior, you know, as someone you could aspire to be. You could aspire to be a fighter and a poet. And, you know, his wonderful expression, you know, that, you know, revolution is to, you know, make revolution as an act of love, you know, and all those things. So, you know, I think that he remains a powerful figure for a lot of people. I highly recommend, for anyone who's ever interested in learning more about Che Guevara, John Lee Anderson's amazing biography, just Che, A Life, that he wrote several years ago, because it's a really wonderful look at the person and the times that he was, you know, came from.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO FM. I'm Eric Tegadoff, your host, and I've been speaking with Hector Tobar, who wrote the book Deep Down Dark, about 33 Chilean miners who were trapped for 69 days. It was about 5 years ago.
2010, yes.
Yeah, 5 years ago in August, last month. And it's a wonderful book, and I suggest it to everyone. It's a really great depiction of these men who have become larger than life, bringing them back down to size and making them really, really human, I think.
Oh, well, thank you so much for saying that. Thank you. Yeah, it's out now in paperback from Picador. And it has the paperback has some pictures that weren't in the hardcover and also a cast of characters. So, yeah, it was a great pleasure to be here and to talk about my books. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that was Eric Tegetoff on the Radio Zine. Coming up, it's Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News, talking about ExxonMobil and its shenanigans. Why don't we just go directly to